at one time they'd done the table search, was September 78, and they were slapping me and kicking me and punching me in the head, and I climbed off the table totally naked. He says, "You have to strip us naked and then do that on us." But it doesn't take one man, it took 5 years to do that. He says, you're going to pay for that. Oh, are you threatening us? And I did that with the finger. I did that. And they knew what that meant. Trigger finger. Oh, you threatening us? I says, you're going to pay for that. This will not go unpunished. You're going to pay for that. Sufficient evidence to suggest that the British were involved in this. The Ministry of Defence were involved in the execution of Michael. The conspiracy to setting him up and the agents involved. So the writ has been served on the Ministry of Defence. Working for the British military. He was a military intelligence officer, Seamus. He was interrogating your brother in Dundalk. That completely changed everything for me. And he says that whole unit were infiltrated. So don't forget. Don't be blaming everything on Freddie Scabatici, Seamus. That whole unit were infiltrated. He gave me the names of them. He wrote them down, gave me the names. I have those names. They're now with my solicitor.
Okay, so very good. You're in the active service unit. You said you were going strong there for about a year and a half. What led to you eventually being imprisoned? What was your charge?
It was an ambush of a UDR soldier on the 28th of January 77. I was in charge of the operation. But I had a bad feeling about it, John. You know, there's like a, when you're at this and it's finely tuned, operations can be finely tuned. And that particular one, I looked at it, I'd done a recon, I went, no. I said to the battalion 00, I don't like that. She says, what do you not like about it? I just don't like the terrain. I don't like the way it's happening. And he was carrying civilians one time when I went down. He goes, I'm not shooting civilians. He says, what do you mean? He says, there's one in the passenger seat. There's a UDR soldier. He's the driver, but there's three in the back. I have no problem shooting him, but that's a moving target. Them three at the back, at least two of them are getting shot. I'm shooting them in the back too, at a moving target. I'm not doing that. So in the end, I was caught on that. And the RUC arrived. I ordered the driver to crash through the checkpoint. He did. They opened fire. I was in the back of the van. I had a 45 revolver, and the other guy had a 38 Smith & Wesson. And crashed in the church. Got away. But then the chase is in an armored vehicle and eventually caught us about a mile away at a church on the Anderson's Town Road, St. Agnes' Church. It's taken to Dunmurry Barracks and then Castlereagh, 5 days in Castlereagh.
What was the actual crime you got charged with?
I was charged with conspiracy to murder a member of the security forces, possession of firearms with intent to endanger life. Caught red-handed.
Do you remember the feeling of when the penny dropped that I'm caught now?
I remember them throwing me at the church. It was a freezing day. The snow was coming down. And I remember looking up at the sky and the snow was coming down. And I went, my feelings at the time, in all honesty, I was tired. I felt tired. It was like fatigue. And I was impairing my judgment. And I looked at my watch. I was in charge of the app. He hadn't come. He meant to be there at 8 exactly. And I says, give it another couple of minutes. I shouldn't have done that. I knew that. And because as I say, operations are finely tuned. And I says, give it another couple of minutes. I give it another 5. And I knew that I shouldn't have given that another 5 and I would have got away. But I give it another 5 because I didn't want to be under that bridge again. And I'm not coming back here. And give it another 5. Don't know why I did that. Just went, he might show up and he may be late himself. And when I was in Castlereagh, the special branch officer had on the point. He was 100% right. He says, no, the problem with you on that operation, Kearney, from a strategic point of view, you give it too long. You should have been away. You hung about. And I knew that. He was right. You hung about because they were as good as us. They were as good as us. We were fighting a war. And we've been at it now 7 years. This is 7 years into a guerrilla war. So they were good at their job. They knew about battle tactics. So did we. So he says, you give it 2-0. Too cocky. That's your problem. And he was right. I give it 2-0. If I had left 3 minutes earlier, I would have got away.
How long was it that you were eventually imprisoned?
It was in my 10th year, nearly 10 years.
10 years, boy. How long of that time were you like part of the protest? You might explain to people who don't know. When you get arrested, you can get arrested and imprisoned as like a common criminal or political prisoner. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, basically, when we were caught, it was after the 1st of March 76. So after, before the 1st of March 1976, you could have got political status. It was won by Billy McHugh, who I've mentioned earlier. He led a hunger strike. He was also involved in the Battle of St Matthews. He's a bit of a hero, a local hero, Billy McHugh. He was involved in the Battle of St Matthews. He was one of the architects of the formation of the Provisional IRA. But in May 72, he led a hunger strike, which gained us political status as soldiers. And William Whitelaw, at the time, the Secretary of State, granted political status in May 72 for captured combatants. But in 1976, the British reneged on all that, done an about turn, and introduced a three-pronged military strategy. It was formulated in London in the autumn of 75. And basically what they said was, we'll scrap political status, we'll not give them the recognition, we'll starve them of the publicity of this thing that they're soldiers. And what we'll do is we'll introduce a three-pronged military strategy called Ulsterization, Normalization, and Criminalization. Ulsterization was going to basically take the British Army out of the front line and put them into a supportive role and push the RUC and the local forces like the Ulster Defence Regiment, Indigenous or Native forces, push them into the front line, let them die, and the body bags come back to London. So it was based on Vietnamization. The Americans actually formulated that 2 years after the Tet Offensive of January 1968 in Vietnam. And Vietnamization was introduced in 1970 by the US government, US Army. They said, right, there's too many body bags, come back to Washington. So we'll push Native forces into the front line, which was the AVRN, the South Vietnamese Army, Indigenous forces or Native forces. Let them do the fighting, push them into the front line. And the US Army went back and went into a supportive role from 1970 right through until the end of that war in April 1975. So you had Ulsterization. The British took that from the American model and went, flip, instead of it being Vietnamization, we'll have this Ulsterization, which meant British forces go into a supportive role, push the natives into the front role, which is the RUC and the Ulster Defence Regiment, Native forces, and let them carry the con. And that's Ulsterization. Normalization was built leisure centres, built restaurants, built Greek, French, Indian restaurants. Give a semblance of normality. That's called normalization, even in a war zone. Create this thing where there is no war here. It's all a fiction. There's just a law and order issue. And the only people to deal with that is policemen dealing with terrorists or mafia, gunmen. And criminalization was to be their main plank. They reckoned it was to be the soft underbelly of the IRA, their prisoners. Strip them naked, disarm them, strip them naked, and put them into this new camp, which was formed, called the Haze Blocks, or the Maze Prison, they called it. It's still Long Cash, but they built this new camp called the Maze Prison, which was close. It butted on to the Long Cash concentration camp, where you had the political prisoners in cages and given all the privileges of POWs. This camp would be 8 concrete Haze Blocks at £1 million a piece, with cells, and this was to be the knacker's yard of the IRA. This was to be the breaker's yard. Strip them, individually put them into these cells and break them down and criminalize them. They're not soldiers, but destroy them physically and psychologically. It was brutal, but it was ingenious strategy from the British. I have to give them that. It was brilliant strategy, but it was known as Ulsterization, Normalization, Criminalization. Those were the 3 points of the three-pronged military strategy formulated in London, MI5 think tank, autumn 75. It came into effect on the 1st of March 76. Any prisoners coming in from now on, yous are criminals, and yous are going into the H block system where the criminals belong. So when I arrived, I was sentenced to 14 years done, caught in active service, went to Moray Barracks, and then Castlereagh 5 days, then Crumlin Road Prison, and then eventually sentenced and sent to the H Block 5. I arrived there on the 5th of October, 1977. Walked in, stripped, and then marched in to see the governor, completely naked. And the governor, Mr. Irwin, said, "Do you know where you are, Kearney?" I says, "Longcash?" "No, you're in the new prison, HMP Mays Cellular. Your number is 998. "What's your number?" "I haven't got a number." "Your number is 998. So you're also you're in an NCP block. That's a non-conforming prisoner block, or an NCP. And so we're advising you to put on the prison uniform, go to work. Are you prepared to do that?" "No." "Why is that?" "Because I'm a soldier." No. "There's no soldiers here," he said to me. He says, "There's only the British Army. So there's no soldiers. There's only criminals. And that's what you are." I says, "I was actually caught in active service trying to ambush a British soldier, UDR soldier." No. He says, "That's a criminal conspiracy you were involved in. So see everything that you've been taught, Kearney? Forget about it. Negate it. It's here. You're a criminal, and you're in a criminal prison for criminals." And that was the start of a long, drawn-out duel between me and the prison service. And it was an individual battle. Everybody had to fight individually here, you know, because that's the way it was designed. They were going to break you individually. So everyone had to be strong, you know. It wasn't like the IRA fighting on the outside. You were fighting as an army out there. Now you're on your own. And you were being deliberately broken down psychologically and physically, individually on your own. So he says, "I advise you to put on the uniform, because if you don't, then this is what awaits you." I says, what does that, if I don't wear the uniform, what does that entail?" "Right," he says, "you'll be locked in a cell 24 hours a day, naked, and you'll not be getting out." I says, "What about fresh air?" "No. The only fresh air you'll get is coming into the cell. No exercise, totally naked and put on a number one starvation diet, total sensory deprivation. You think you could do 14 years like that?" And I stupidly said, I'll try. "I'll try." That was day one. I was the 5th of October 77. I was A-Wing H Block 5. And that continued. I remained on the blanket protest for 4 years and 10 days. Like that.
Okay, so
my greatest, people would say, "What's the high watermark of your career?" You know, I got out of prison, I formed my own business, I had married, I had three children, you know. But the high watermark of my career, looking back, was the blanket protest. 4 years and 10 days. That was a triumph. That was my forte. That's a great, for me, that's a great human achievement, if you know what I mean. You know, they said, you'll not be able to do that. We'll throw everything but the kitchen sink at you. And I went, bring it on. And that's the type of stay will that you needed.
4 years of solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement, 4 years, 10
no,
days.
No getting out of your cell, no contact out of prison, 4 years.
Yeah, and on a starvation diet. Enough food to keep you alive, but no more. No. You'll get a few chips, slice of razor-thin beef. Razor-thin, you can see your eyes through it. You can see right through it. We call it razor meat or razor-thin meat. And a couple of chips. And then in the morning, soggy porridge. And the bread was stuck, two or three rounds of bread stuck in the porridge. You had to pull, drag the bread out, soggy bread, and eat it, and then the porridge. But a cup of watery tea. And then that night, you could get, on a Friday, you would get fish with no fish, just the batter, and a few peas, and that'll do you. Oh my God, you were just constantly starving, gnawing away at you.
What does a person do to occupy your mind and stop yourself going insane having that day repeated for 4 years? That's over 1,200 days.
You have to fall back into your own resources. That's what I called it. You have to fall back into your own resources. You have to drain yourself of all emotion. That's the hardest part. I'd already done that on the outside. But you have to actually now stop feeling sorry for yourself, because you always held this self-pity. You know, poor me, and getting starved. Why me? That's disastrous. You need to stop feeling sorry for yourself. So you have to drain out all emotion, and you have to be steel-willed. You can't be steel-willed if you have a lot of emotion going on in there. Why is people picking on me? Why is people doing this? Why me? Why are they getting on with their lives outside? You know, you have to adapt this attitude. You are a soldier, and I start behaving as a soldier. Soldier to me represents strength and discipline, and that gives me a context. So I am a soldier. I am not a civilian. Civilian to me means asking awkward questions or why me? Why me? Why is this happening? Going to the prison officer, why are you beating me? Could you explain that? I don't know why you're doing this. No, you're a soldier. You expect it. And that got me through those 4 years. Along with other tactics we all started formulating, one of them was walking up and down the cell. I had seen Papillon in 1973 at the cinema in Belfast, and I went, oh, I remember that. Steve McQueen, Dustin Hoffman. Steve McQueen was doing Papillon, and he had this thing about insulting family. He kept walking up and down, but he used the maximum space. And I started doing that the same. Started doing that and the same thing. Started walking up and down the cell and hit my nose to the wall, back and forward, just the way Steve McQueen did it in Papillon, in the film 1973. And he had ways of, you know, wee tactics that he would have had. I started adapting to. You know, he accepted it, and he accepted the situation that he was in, and I did the same. And making full use of the cell, walking up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Take a break. Then 10-minute break, you had no watch. So you imagine 10 minutes, you count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 minutes, do it again, up and down. That went on all day. And then stories, started telling stories. You had a cellmate, and he would say, do you know any stories to keep me from going insane? And I started sort of digging into my resources, digging into my memories. It's pure escapism, but the escapism is a way of holding on to your sanity. You know, and that's what kept you. You needed to remember, and you needed to remember good days which were, you know, weren't all bad, and summer holidays. And he would ask me, "Had you any good summer holidays?" Here's me, yeah, went to Monaghan in 1972. The sun was shining, the birds were, yeah, tell us about that, but take your time, describe the scene. So he would have said, "Hold on, I want to lie down. First, I want to make myself comfortable, and then I want you to describe in detail. That's that particular summer holiday." And you went, this is nuts, you know. But you had to say, well, the scene opens where there's a clear blue sky, the sun is shining, and the birds are right. And here's me, do you get the picture? Yeah, yeah, got it. Keep going. So that's what was going on. Things like that, telling stories, sing songs out the door, walking up and down the cell. And I went on and
you,
on.
You were in a cell with someone else?
Yes.
For the 4 years, you and one other guy?
Yeah. Yeah.
And after the 4 years, what changed?
I know what you're saying. I wasn't total sense solitary confinement. I know what you're saying. Yeah, no, you were locked in a cell with two guys. There was two of you and another guy. But there was occasions of solitary confinement. That's when they took you out of the punishment block. You know, if you for any misdemeanor, they took you down. It was a separate building outside the in the camp, but it had two wings, and it was known as the punishment block. And you would have been in total solitary confinement for up to a week there.
I see. After that 4 years, what the rest of the 6 years, you then had political prisoner status, or?
Well, we won most of the we got of the five demands which we called political status. It was the right to, you know, not to wear a prison uniform. We gained that at the end of the hunger strike of 1981, and then from there we worked on other stuff. So by September 1983, we got all our demands, the five demands, which formulated political status.
Okay.
It had to come to the hunger strike, because conditions were so bad, and we were living in our own excrement. We had a smear excrement on the cell. You're aware of that?
Yes. Yeah, I've heard that that you were supposed to slap out, and that was one of the ways of protesting, that you wouldn't put out the bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, so you put the excrement on the wall, you smeared it on the cell walls, and then you put your urine out every night about 9 o'clock under the door. They flooded the wing, then they squeezed it off. And then basically you had the maggots coming out of the corner in the summer. It was freezing in the winter. The worst thing that they did, from my point of view, was in April 1979, to put these sheets of steel over the cell. A bit like what happened to Papillon. They've done that with him.
I haven't seen that film.
They go one further. The torture, I call it the torture of the tortured. They weren't happy enough beating you, and they did do that. They came in and they would beat you. They would beat you hard, you know, three or four of them, and for no reason, you know, it was just random, and they would sexually assault you by inserting their finger up your anus and then into your mouth. They did that, and they would starve you out with giving you very little food, and then they would throw you across a table and stick their finger up your anus with a rubber glove or a surgical glove, and then into your mouth. They'd done the worst. They were the worst of the worst. They were war criminals. You know,
I was going to say, what they're doing there amounts to
war crime.
It's crimes against humanity type of stuff.
Yeah. And I at one time they'd done the table search was September 78 after they rammed their finger up my anus. And then they were slapping me and kicking me and punching me in the head. And I climbed off the table totally naked. And I was like, I felt violated. And I said to them, why don't you think you're brave? I says, why don't you take your chances at the front line like me? He says, oh, big, rough, tough Provo, are you? He says, that's how we operate. He says, you have to strip us naked and then do that on us. But it doesn't take one man. It took 5 years to do that. He says, you're going to pay for that. Oh, are you threatening us? And I did that. What's the thing? I did that. And they knew what that meant. Trigger finger. Oh, you threaten us? I says, you're going to pay for that. This will not go unpunished. You're going to pay for that. He says, F you Finian, Provo, you know. So it became personal, and the violence against us became so horrific, where they were beating you, sexually assaulting you, putting you underwater in hot tubs of water in December 78. They near drowned me in a tub of water, a bathtub. They were taking you to the punishment block and beating you there. So the beatings they weren't with knuckle dusters or nothing like that. Sometimes they used the baton, sometimes not. But you had to run a gauntlet. Every 9 days you were sent across from one wing to another so that they could clean the cell, because the cell became like a farmyard after 9 days. It was just unbelievable. Hard to describe the smell and the sight of excrement on the ceilings, on the walls. The excrement was in your nails. You were eating food. You were getting worms. You were having dysentery, and you weren't washing. And then they were coming in randomly, hitting you over the head with a steel pocket, or hitting you with a baton, or trying to crush your ribs, just kicking you, punching you. And then during the wing shifts, every 9 days, you had to put you across a table, or else use the mirror search. The mirror was a mirror super glued onto a piece of sponge. They would kick you over the mirror, and then what they called stargazing, they would look up your anus to see if you were carrying contraband. Sometimes they ran the finger up your arse and then into your mouth. It was just pure humiliation and total sensory deprivation from April 79, where they actually cut out the sunlight, actually put sheets of steel over the cell window so you couldn't see out. And it became suffocating, especially when you were going to the toilet and trying to put an excrement on the wall. There was hardly any fresh air coming in. They put not only the sheets of steel on the inside, but also cages on the outside. It was just incredible. Torture of the tortured, I call it. And that was from about April 79 in my block, H4. And so it dragged on and on and on. We weren't forgiven in. They weren't forgiven in. So it came to the point of a hunger strike.
Just to go back before I forget, you mentioned that time when they had been assaulting you, and you gave them that threat. Were any of those threats followed through?
Yeah. Once we issued a threat, they knew that we weren't like the loyalists. The loyalists would issue veiled threats and do nothing about it. They would threaten a hunger strike, but not go on it. They would threaten a blanket protest, but not do it. They hadn't got the will to win. They hadn't got that steel will. We had it on the outside. We brought it into the inside. And the pivotal battle was going to be this defining moment, the Battle of the H-Blocks. And they felt we're going to finally crush the Provisional IRA inside the prisons. And we were going, no, you won't. No, you're not. Yes, the number two governor came in. And he said to me, he was called Albert Miles, And he said, Colonel, you're a criminal. I says, no, not, I'm a soldier. Here we go again. So he says, I'm awarding you 28 days, lost remission, 28 days, blah, blah, blah. And then eventually he took a personal interest. He came in to the H3 in August 1978. He lined all the screws. How I know this is because I had a conversation in 1983 or 84 with a prison officer who was actually on parade. We became friends. It was over. We got political status. He was more liberal in talking to me. And he says, I just happened to say to him, Joe, what was it all that about? He says, were you on the blanket yourself, Mr. Kearney? I said, yeah, yeah. Oh. He says, what block? I says, H block 4. He says, oh, I was in H3. I says, what was it all about, Joe? This is a prison officer who had become a born-again Christian. And he says, well, in August 78, we were all told to line up and parade. And the governor, the number two governor came in, it was Albert Mills. And he addressed us and says, the government are fed up with these protesting prisoners. They're trying to get this policy of criminalization finally wrapped up, get them into criminal uniform. He says, so it's dragged on. And so the governor have told us to tell yous, do whatever it takes to break them. You can bait them, you can starve them out, you can do whatever it takes, but get them in the uniform. And that's by Christmas 78, that's your demarcation line. We want this wrapped up. We want them in criminal uniforms and this so-called blanket protest ended. And you can do what you like. I said, how did you feel, Joe, when they said that? He says, we couldn't believe it. We hated you anyway as Fenians. But even better, we were given a blank check that we could do whatever we want. And so he says, we had up to, that was August 78. We had up to Christmas to do it. So we went berserk. He says, the next wing shift, I actually seen two prison guards jammed in the cell doorway to get at the two streakers, as he called us, blanket men. We were blanket men, but they called us trumps or streakers. He says, I actually seen, that was the hatred we had for you, Colonel. Two prison officers were jammed in the cell opening to get at the prisoners. That's the hatred we had. Rammed their heads into the grills, punched, beat. Oh. He says, it was like a turkey shoot. I says, Joe, you did that? Oh, yes. I admit I did that. But he says, I'm born again Christian now. He says, I've seen the error of my ways. And he says, by the way, that will never happen again. The Prison Officers Association wouldn't allow that to happen. I says, why not? He says, because we were duped. He says, governors, the government duped us. He says, at the end, we lost, yous won. And yous got political status, and we were caught in the middle of that. He says, we were just used as cannon fodder. He says, the government broke. They didn't support us, and they gave us political status in the end. We were duped. That's how he felt.
Were prison officers shot sometimes off duty as
well? Yeah, well, that particular guard, governor, the number two governor, which was Albert Miles, the guy who issued that Christmas 78, the OC of H3 went out and said to him, you've been conducting some terror campaign here. He says, and what? He says, well, you know, you have to be, someone's going to have to be accountable for this horror of men getting beat and everything that's been happening. And Miles turned around to the OC of H3 in December, or sorry, it wasn't December, it was around about October. Yeah, October. And he said, see, anything that happens, I stand by my staff. I'm the ones giving the orders. I'm the ones going to make sure that yous go into the criminal uniform and are broke. He says, well, on your head, babe. So on the 28th of November, 1978, he was having tea that Sunday night in North Belfast, and two IRA volunteers went and shot him dead. He was shot twice in the stomach and then shot twice through the head. And he died with a cup of tea in his hand. And that was Albert Mays. How did I feel when the word came in that Albert Mays, Fierce Boss, he's dead? Everyone just run for the piss pots, drained them, and started banging the cell doors. It was we were triumphalist over it. Couldn't believe it, because he was the main instigator of that torture, and he had paid a heavy price for it. The next day, the screws' morale hit rock bottom, and our morale sky high. And that's the truth. There was none of this, oh, that's terrible. No, how we felt at the time was, you need to stop this. No, we're not stopping it. Well, you're going to pay a price. And so what? What are you going to do? But the IRA did it for us. They shot him dead.
Okay, I don't want to keep you too long. So I'll kind of fast forward a little bit. You eventually get out of prison. I read on your Facebook page you have a few posts about it. Tough thing to talk about, I'm sure, but your younger brother was eventually killed after being falsely labeled an informant, and it was done by a man who passed recently, who's I think you would say the most famous most famous rat in IRA history, is codenamed Steak Knife. He was actually head of the squad.
That's Freddy Scapatici.
Mind rats. Would you mind telling us a bit about that? It was a tragic thing to be for.
Well, on the 12th of July 79, Michael was shot dead, and he was left at the border near Newton Butler. It was just out, it was between Clonus and Newton Butler on the 12th of July 79. And when I went out on the visit, I had a priest visit that day, Father Matt Wallace. I thought it was the British Army or the RUC because I knew he was in the IRA, but he said it was the Irish Republican Army, and that completely bamboozled me. And initially I thought at the time, well, if the IRA did that and he was an informer, then he deserved it. But no one approached me from 1979 right until I got out in 1986. I was in the dark. No one actually approached me to say what had happened, just that he was an informer. So when I got out on Valentine's Day, 1986, and went for a walk with my mum. And that was the start of it. My mum said to me, with the dog, Rory, there was me, my mum, and the dog, Rory. We were walking down the Glen Road, and this would have been about early March, 1986. She says, son, what are you for doing? What's your plans for the future? You're still young. I was 29. I says, I'm not really sure, mum. I think I'll take R&R for a while to get my head short. Maybe go on the continent for a while to Spain or somewhere like that. And also wanted to hit back at the British for murdering 10 of my comrades on hunger strike. So I came out with a sort of bitterness, and I wanted to make them pay for what they'd done in the H blocks. That's how I felt. And she says, I understand that, son. I completely understand that. But she says, I stood by you for nearly 10 years. Now I want you to stand by me. I says, what do you mean, stand by you? She says, I'll give you a job to do, and the only person who can do it is you. I need you to go back in time, find out what happened to my son, Michael. I says, Mum, that was what, 79? 80, 81, 82, 83, 84, near 7 years ago. You need to let it go. Michael was an informer. Probably would have shot him myself. He says, I understand that, son, but I need you to go back in time and find out, was he an informer? And he says, the only person who could do it is you, because you're obsessive. And I should know, I give birth to you. There's nobody that I know can do this. And he says, you beat the British in the battle of criminalization, and well done. I says, Mom, I did that because you supported me. You could have broke me in August 79 when you come up on a visit, but you didn't. You supported me. And she says, well, I did. And but I need you to support me. So I made her a promise, John, that I would try to find out what happened to him. But it was a poison chalice. And I told her at the time, Mom, that's a poison chalice. The IRA has never cleared anyone, any of their volunteers. And then they hadn't. There was no record of it as far back as 1916 when they were formed through the Irish Volunteers and the Irish Citizen Army, you know. And why were they going to start? If they were going to do it, it would be completely unprecedented. And my mum says, well, you're the one that can break new ground. There's nobody else can do it. So after several failed attempts, in 2001, the political climate was changing. I heard McGuinness say things like, it's time to heal the wounds. It's time for, you know, to come forward and to find out, to help, you know, help create a new Ireland. Heal wounds, reconciliation, conflict resolution. And I felt this is the time to do this. So I formed my own group of five men. They're all former IRA guys who had been in the prison with me on the blanket. And we put a formula together. And without going into the great detail of it, it was that I didn't do that on my own. I didn't do that on my own. I did it with the five ex-IRA guys who were with me. Well, I was I was the fifth man, but there was five of us. And out of that, we got the IRA to come forward and to launch an investigation, which commenced in October 2001, into the circumstances surrounding the death of a volunteer called Michael Kearney. And I was asked by the IRA, you know, to park a motion. Was I capable of doing that? And I said, yeah, I'm a soldier. And they said, right, so the point of contact with the family would be me, and we would park a motion, and we would clinically go through what happened to Michael. And that's what the IRA did. They were successful in doing that. And on the 20th of January 2003, the investigation commenced in October 2001. It ended on the 20th of January 2003, and they issued a statement to the family and clearing Michael of any suggestion that he was a paid informer. Yep. And also, he had been mentioned in dispatches as being the man responsible for a big operation called the Short Strand Bombs. I'm just going to read this out. This is called Ballymurphy in the Irish War. And Michael was fingered for this. And it said, in March 1979, Ballymurphy volunteers were involved in one of the biggest military operations planned by the IRA in the North. 42 bombs were prepared and stored in a warehouse in the Short Strand for what a senior IRA volunteer would later describe as the one that, if it had come off, would have ended the war. However, the British were tipped off, and a large contingent of Special Air Service troops, SAS, were moved into the Short Strand area in East Belfast in a joint RUC Army operation maneuver. Upwards to 30 IRA volunteers were to have taken part in the operation, and the heavy deployment of the SAS, many according to the IRA, arriving disguised as workers and Department of the Environment lorries and vans, would suggest the British intention of devastating the Belfast Brigade with a major killing of volunteers. However, the stakeout was badly coordinated by the RUC and the Brits. Eventually, the SAS pulled back long enough for all units to get away. They didn't go in for the kill. And afterwards, the Brits and the RUC spent ages blaming one another for the screw-up. It was a British military screw-up. Then in July 1979, an IRA volunteer named Michael Kearney, my brother, was shot dead near the border for tipping the Brits off about the bombs. Michael Kearney was an informer. So you get the picture? He's getting shot for the Short Strand bombs.
Was it the case? I've heard during Steak Knife's career there was many an occasion when he basically kind of offered up another member as being a spy when in reality it was him, and it was to further his own position, and it was to take spotlight off him. Was that the case here? Was it Scappaticci orchestrating it for his own protection? Like
no. No, so it's bigger than that. If you're interested, if you're a student of this counterintelligence or counterinsurgency war, which I am, then you really, 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 really need to listen. What I have been at for the last 40 years, along with trying to get Michael cleared, which I did do, I successfully did that in 2003, and the IRA leadership helped me to do that. But while that was going on, that was the 20th of January, 2003. In May, a few months later, I was still meeting the IRA up until September of that year. In May, Greg Harkin, a journalist, went to a house in Riverdale, and Freddie Scappaticci opened the door, and then Greg Harkin said, "You're the agent, Steak Knife." He denied it, but when I met the IRA during that period, I says that completely puts a different perspective on this, and I says, did you interview Scap? He said, yep. I says, is he a British military officer? Or is he an IRA volunteer interrogating my brother? And they were evasive. So my group then said, well, there seems to be a lot of disinformation here. And there was a lot of disinformation, without going into the detail, there was a lot of confusion at that time. And there was people saying that he was a hardworking Republican stitched up a gutter press, a British inspired media. So there was confusion. And they had interviewed him. They had said that he'd played a role in the execution of Michael Kearney, but not a central role, which I didn't really understand what that meant. But the IRA had confirmed that Scappaticci was with Michael in the same room interrogating him. So I was saying to my own team, is this an agent interrogating my brother, which completely negates the whole process? And he says, well, the only person who can answer that is Brenton Hughes. So why don't you go down and see him? So I did. I went down and met him in June 2003, Brenton Hughes. And I explained to him what had happened. Michael had been cleared, but this thing the month earlier, but Greg Hargan approaching Scabatici, what was all that about? He sat me down in his flat, top flat in Divis Tower. He says, Seamus, I was GHQ intelligence. He says, when did you get out? I says, he was known as the Dark. He was a good friend of mine. He was also our leader in the jail. And I says, that February 86. He says, well, I got out in November. Here's me, yeah. And he says, the following year, I took over GHQ intelligence. And part of my remit was looking after internal security. I wasn't a member of it. I had an overarching reach on them. And he says, so Freddie Scabatici was a British military officer. And he was attached to the Force Research Unit, which was formed. When was that? You were the man with the dates, Seamus. I says, that wasn't actually formed in 70. He was probably working for British Military Intelligence, Dark, but Force Research Unit was formed the following year, 1980. There you go. So he's working for the British military. He was a military intelligence officer, Seamus. He was interrogating your brother in Dundalk. That completely changed everything for me. And he says, that whole unit were infiltrated. So don't forget. Don't be blaming everything on Freddie Scabatici, Seamus. That whole unit were infiltrated. He gave me the names of them. He wrote them down, gave me the names. I have those names. They're now with my solicitor. And I says, that whole unit? Mm-hmm. I says, I would have thought that, Dark, because Scab couldn't have done that on his own. No, absolutely not. Scabatici could not have done all that on his own. Because you would have had people who are working close. And if that had been the genuine articles, they would have turned around and says, what the hell are you doing? I'm reporting you to Brigade. I'm reporting you to the Army Council. What the hell are you shooting people like that? Are you nuts? So the whole unit were infiltrated. They had to be. And that's what we knew. That's what the Dark told me in June 2003. So that whole unit were infiltrated. The head of the unit, it was formed in autumn of 1978. And it was led not by Skip. It was led by a member of the Special Boat Service. And he was an agent. He was working for Special Branch. He ran the unit. He was the head of it. He was feeding information back to the Special Branch, the head of the unit. Scabatici was part of the unit, but he wasn't the head of it when it was formed in autumn 78. The head of the unit was actually working for Special Branch. The Brits couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe their luck that they had actually formed a unit that they could infiltrate. And they did. Right from day one, they had infiltrated. The others were also working as agents. So eventually, in 2003, June, I was aware of that. So I knew my mum wouldn't have lasted forever, John. And I went along with the sanitized version. That's what it's called, the sanitized version, where the IRA had cleared Michael. I went along with that. And even though I knew there would be a part two, I told the IRA that. I said, there will be a part two to this. But my mum's she's not going to survive this. So I kept that away from my mother. I went down, she was living in Downpatrick at the time, and I had made a promise to her. She read the army report, which cleared Michael, and she turned around and she says to me, I told you, you were obsessed. I says, yeah, but I delivered on the promise. Oh, no. She says, now I can go to my grave knowing that my son's good name and his honor has been restored. That meant everything to her, and it meant everything to me, because living a mortal existence, it's not all what it's cut out to be. You know, you live, you're born, you live a life. Most people, probably 90%, live a mediocre life. Some of them are lucky enough to get to 70 or 75 or 80. And then some of them look back on their lives and go, what was all that about? And then they die. So the war that we fought wasn't mediocre. The people who fought in that war were not mediocre. My brother wasn't mediocre. I wasn't mediocre. We were fighting a war. We were doing, this was for the common good. We had great aims and ideals. And so my mum understood that, even though she wasn't actually a Republican. She used to say to me, I'm not a Republican. I just stood by my two sons. But integrity and honor meant everything to my mother. That's the way we were brought up. We were brought up to believe in God and to believe in country, faith in country. And that's how we lived our lives. Our Michael died as a soldier. And I fought as a soldier. And I believed in those virtues. I'm flawed. We're all flawed. We're not, you know, we're not saints, but we always try to be the best. And that's what Michael tried to be. At the time, up until 2003, I didn't know what way that was going. If he was an informer and they had to come back and said he was an agent, he deserved it, then I would have had the job of having to go down to Downpatrick to tell my mother. And hey, the army had actually told me in 2001, could you brace your mother for the worst? We'll expect the worst, but hope for the best. And I told my mom, this is an investigation which could end up demonizing Michael, basically confirming that he was an agent. And she turned around for a plater. She says, well, son, do you know what it is? If the IRA can prove that my son was an informer, then he betrayed you. He betrayed the cause of Ireland. He betrayed his own people. And even though I love my son, then I would actually have to let him go. That takes a lot for a mother to say that, John. But as it turned out, he was cleared. And when I went down in the start of February, 2003, she read the report and she says, I can go to my grave now knowing that my son's honour and his good name has been restored. So it helped my mum. But part two of the story wasn't, I didn't think of it. Well, I remember sitting with a 5-man group and said, I wouldn't even go along with that sanitised version, because you know there's a part two. You know it's Scapitici. The Dark's told you, even though all these lunatics out here are saying that he's a hardworking Republican stitched up by British media. You know he's not. You know that he's an agent. You know that he's a British military. The Dark has told you that. You know that whole unit's infiltrated. So I go along with it. I says, I'm doing it for my mum. So I went along with it. There was all a big fanfare at the time. We had a great mass for him, a Republican mass for him on June the 22nd, 2003. Father Matt Wallace was there, the man who delivered the bad news to me on the 12th of July, 79, the man who done the mass for Michael at the time in 79. He was at the funeral mass for him. And then he was there on June the 22nd, 2003. And it was a glorious day, John. And on that day, it was a commemoration mass for Michael, the fact that his honour had been restored. There was over 1,000 people at it, 1,000 people. And he says, this is a great day. And it's great to see that Kathleen has lived to see that day. And it's great to see that Seamus is here. And, you know, so it healed a lot of wounds, but it still remained the fact that Scapitici was at the centre of this, and he was a British military officer, and I knew that because the Dark had told me it. And so, as it turned out, after it was over, Michael was cleared, got the, you know, the fanfare was over. I was working on a job in July 2016. It was a rewire, and I got a phone call, and this was the beginning of part two of the same story. And it was from my solicitor, Kevin Winters. And he says, could you call down to the office someday? Here's me, why? I'm busy. What are you doing? I says, I'm doing a rewire of a house in Rosetta, in South Belfast. He says, well, I don't want to say too much, but sure, why don't you call down? So I called down 3 or 4 weeks later, and there was 3 solicitors sitting there. And one of the solicitors, Kevin, says, I says, what's this about? He says, we're going to ask you a few questions and see how intelligent you are, see how knowledgeable you are on the answers. He says, okay, go ahead. I hadn't a clue what he was going to say. He says, what's your view of Freddie Scapitici? Here's me flip. I says, for what it's worth, and I know there's a lot of disinformation out there, a lot of cover-up, a lot of smoke and mirrors, but Freddie Scapitici is not actually a hard-working Republican from Riverdale in West Belfast, stitched up by British media. He's actually a British military officer attached to the Force Research Unit, 14th Intelligence Company, the biggest spy since the Second World War. That's who he is. And the 3 solicitors looked at each other and said, my God, he says, where'd you get that information? Why have you not went along with the rest? Here's me, I don't go, I've always been able to think for myself, first of all. And secondly, I spoke to Brenton Hughes. He told me the truth, right? He says, well, Brenton Hughes is correct, Jimus. He's a British military agent, and his code name is Steak Knife. That was part two, started in July, August. 2016, and that's been part two of my journey, which takes me right up to this second where I'm talking to you, and it's still a job in progress.
While you were like an active member, were you aware? I know Scapitici only joined, I think, kind of late 70s or so, but even at that time when you were still active, were you aware of someone? Were you aware of a man named Scapitici who was there? The Nothing Squad. This only came out.
No, I only heard about him in 1986. Someone said to me, what's your plans for Miguel? It was my cousin. And we were in Bangor. And he brought up this name. I just got out, went down to see him. And he says, have you looked at what happened to Miguel? Has anyone told you when you're in the prison? I says, nobody's come near me. He says, right. He says, well, see if it ever lands on your lap. Remember this name. Here's me. Go ahead. He says, Freddie Scabatici had your Miguel. Flip. Who's he? I says, is he an ice cream man? He says, no, he's not. Apparently he's an IRA man. And apparently he had a he was close to the interrogation of Miguel. And that's when I first heard that. That was March 86. I never heard of him before. Knew nothing about him.
I assume you'd have been aware, even before you were aware of Scappaticci, of a team known as like the Notting Squad
Yeah,
then.
I knew about them.
Yeah.
I was aware of them.
Had you ever had it ever happened where someone who you knew, trusted, worked with later did turn out to be like a legitimate informer?
Outside of that unit.
As in, like someone that you had previously worked on some job somewhere that turned out to be a rat.
That's what's Operation Canova at the moment. That rat.
Come again, the Operation What?
That name has been handed to Operation Canova, the rat.
The one that you had worked with. What's that like? Just as a. As an emotion when you figure out that someone who you trusted and who could have put you away or had you killed or something was actually not on your side.
Completely devastating would be an understatement, John. Completely devastating doesn't really cut it. It's someone that's close to you, rubbing skin with you. It's actually an agent. Canova has just simply said he's a person of interest in this, known as the familiar face. That's what we call him, the familiar face.
There's a particular rat that's known as the familiar, and his identity hasn't been made public.
No. He's known as the familiar face. Canova said he's a person of interest. He was actually involved in the execution of your brother. He's known as local knowledge or the familiar face.
If you don't mind me asking, you said that a lot of the information that you kind of unearthed is with your solicitor now. You mentioned meetings with your solicitor. Are you in the middle of a legal case or bringing something? Are you
We've
involved with it?
served a writ. I've served a writ on the Ministry of Defence. The writ was served a few months ago there. That was on the advice of my solicitor. He said there's sufficient evidence to suggest that the British were involved in this. The Ministry of Defence were involved in the execution of Miguel, the conspiracy to setting him up and the agents involved. So the writ has been served on the Ministry of Defence.
I don't know if this is a coincidence, but there's a kind of a report or a commission coming soon. What's the name of there? Let me have a look.
It's Operation Canova. It's led by John Boucher. It commenced in June 2016. It had a 5-year remit. It was meant to end in June 21, and it's went on and on and on.
We're talking about the
I
legacy and
actually, actually,
reconciliation.
pardon?
We're talking about the legacy and reconciliation bill, right?
No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about Operation Canova, which is to investigate an individual codenamed Steak Knife and also the IRA's internal security unit. So that went on. That remit was June 2016 to June 21. It was given 35 million. That's now went up to 37 million. And the begs the question, oh my God, if I have unearthed this information and I haven't made one penny out of this, and that didn't need one penny, what the hell's going on with 37 million? So it begs the question of, how do you validate that? And it still hasn't really, the report was meant to come out in January 2023. I've already met John Boucher. I've met him twice. I've met the family liaison officer. I've spoke to him, I've met him. And he said the report will be out in January 2023, and then February, and then March, and then April, and then May, and then June. Now it's September. And, you know, you say to yourself, 37 million, 5 years, went past its sell by date. It's now 23, and it's still going on. The money's still getting pumped into those 70 personnel from the London and the outer London area. They're still making a huge amount of money, and you're saying to yourself, nothing's being delivered. Up to now. I think John Boucher is well-intentioned, but I have to be perfectly honest. I say to myself, okay, is it national security? Probably is. I'm not saying it's not, but it's now getting security checked at Whitehall at the minute. In other words, ask my brother, am I a liar? The same people that I've served a writ on, they're now security checking him, his report before it's released. So right away, I have a jaundiced view of it all. You understand? So the people that I've served the writ on, Ministry of Defence, are now looking at that report that he's meant to release, and they're holding it back. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, they're trying to push through legacy, which is what you talked about earlier, the reconciliation bill. They're trying to push that through as quickly as possible. It's now been stalled to the 5th of September, 2023. They try to ram it through for 27th of July, before the summer recess, 25th, 27th of July. They failed to do that because it was playing ping pong politics between the House of Lords and the House of Commons. It's now put back to the 5th of September. They're trying to get it through to make it law to cover their troops and to cover all their dirty tricks. So this story, John, to call us, I always love to, always like that when I give it, when someone gives me a question, I like to give them a direct answer. This is about the British. It's not really about the IRA. The IRA were duped. So, you know, this is the architects of the dirty war were the British. The architects of the dirty war were the British government and its surrogates. The IRA were duped. So, for example, Michael, the reason why we served the writ on the Ministry of Defence, and we believe it's a strong enough case, is because Michael's murder, his killing, was organised in Castlereagh. They made a decision, and we have the proof. They made the decision to release him, to hand him over to Scapatici and that internal security unit, not to protect Scapatici. He didn't need to be protected. That unit didn't need to be protected. They were invaded in by the IRA, but the IRA were carrying out their procedure. They didn't know they were in the agents, but they were, Michael was then taken down south. And it was from that point on, we know the paper trail. We know, for example, on July the 6th, Scapatici is reporting back to his handler, along with the head of internal security, who's the member, former member of the Special Boat Service. He's also reporting back. We know that. We have that detail. Both the head of the internal security unit and Scapatici are reporting back to their respective handlers that Michael Kearney's situation is grave, that he's getting charged with breach of General Army Orders, July the 6th. This is 6 days before he's executed. And we also we know through Scapatici's miser. Scapatici has wrote a miser. He didn't write it, but his handlers wrote a miser. A miser is a military intelligence source report, MISR. We also know that the SB50 form has been wrote on behalf of the internal security unit, the head of it. He's also contacted his handler. His form is an SB50 contact form. That's how the RUC operate their forms. The military, because Scapatici belongs to the military, he's told his handler, the handler's wrote out his MISR, his MISR. That was found in Whitehall in 2019. Scapatici is telling the handler, this is dire for Michael Kearney. He's getting executed. And it says he's put in an appeal, but it is unlikely the appeal will succeed. That's Scapatici's exact words. He's put in an appeal, but it is unlikely that it will succeed. And why? It's because of this. They're going to put him down for the short strand bombs. So Michael's going to get executed for this to cover two of their own informers. Not Scap. Scap doesn't need to be protected. It's two informers, but they're going to facilitate this. they are being told by the handlers are telling Skip and the other boyo, let that run. Because this is all started in Castlereagh. He's getting shot. So it's on a need to know basis. They're not actually telling Skip, oh, this is the reason. Just run with that. In other words, give the impression, just run with that. Get me? Run. In other words, Michael's not getting shot to cover Skip. Skip doesn't need covered. Michael's getting covered for the guy who's responsible for the bombs being found in the short strand.
This is the man who they're covering from is the person you're referring to as a familiar face, or is it someone different?
Yes. He's the one in West Belfast. The familiar face is getting protected in West Belfast. But there's also a member. They're doing a double dunder. The guy in the short strand, he's in the warehouse. He's in the warehouse. That's the reason why the SAS don't go for the kill. They're about to go into the warehouse. There's 30 volunteers about. They are going for a panzer kill. They're going for a kill. But they've been told to stand down. They can't go into the warehouse because one of their agents are in the warehouse. That's what the SAS are being told, stand down. One of our agents are in that warehouse. You're going to shoot him. So they're stood down.
Sorry. The familiar face isn't that guy. A separate one.
He's not in the warehouse.
Okay, he's separate.
He's separate.
I gotcha. Okay.
It's quite complex. So they could have charged Michael, but they've decided not to. And they've decided to release him to cover two agents, one in West Belfast, one in East. So Michael's getting executed. He's getting stitched up the back. The problem with this, John, I'm going to tell you this for the first time. I've never spoke about this, but I'm going to tell you it now. Something goes technically wrong while Michael's down south.
While he's being interrogated?
Yes, something goes wrong. Skip realizes, oh my God, what has happened here? And what goes wrong is this. Michael was lifted on Wednesday, June the 20th. He's released 3 days later, Saturday, June the 23rd. He's handed over to internal security on Monday, June the 25th. He's down there for 16 days. He's court-martialed on July the 6th. He's going to be executed on July the 12th. Scapatici has told the handlers he's getting shot. It's up to, not up to Scapatici. It's up to the handlers to report back to their superiors. He can be saved, but they've decided no. Why? Because they've already put a target on his back in Castlereagh and sent him out for a reason. He's been given a role. So to cover these two agents, Scapatici and the internal security, as they will do in the future, will facilitate these executions. Michael's the first, by the way. Michael Kearney's the first. He's not the last. He's the first. But this is the beginning of the pattern where they're going to use internal security for their own ends. If they are going to decide who goes, who lives, and who dies. The British decide. It's not the IRA. The IRA may rubber stamp it. Army Council may rubber stamp stuff. But it's based on the trust that they have had in internal security. Do you get me? So, something goes seriously wrong on July the 6th when Scapatici says to Michael, you were responsible for the short strand bombs. They're accusing him. And for the first time, Michael says, no, no. You drove them over, yep, which he did do. So he was involved in that, which implicates him, sets him up. So he delivered the 42 bombs to the short strand. But they say to him, well, we think you're the informer. But Michael does something. He's on the ropes. He defends himself. No, it's not me. Anyway, it's in my debriefing report. That's when the alarm bells go off. Where's that? They should have picked that up. It's a technical error on their behalf. He should have had the debriefing report with him. They were going to destroy it, but they couldn't destroy it if it wasn't with them. Scapatici says, where's that? Is that with you? No. Now there's alarm bells ringing. Where's that? that debriefing report will prove my innocence. That's a dilemma for them. We need to get that. Where is that?
The report.
He says it's in a cornflakes box in our house, 23 Glenvie Drive, in the kitchen. There's an alarm bells ringing. They need to get that. That's a paper trail back to them. So they send somebody to get it. Can't find it. My brother Sean opens the door. He says they were looking at it. I searched for it and couldn't find it. They said it's in a cornflakes box. He said, I'd only come back from Germany. I didn't know what they were talking about. But apparently our Michael said it was in a cornflakes box, but I couldn't find the bloody cornflakes box. It wasn't in the kitchen. I asked my mum. Mum was sitting in the living room. She said, I don't know what you're talking about. So they went back empty handed, but it was to be their downfall. And they went back to Michael and said they couldn't find it. But in that report on page 3, it said, we followed you over to the Shore Strong. They told him, he wasn't telling them. That would have proved his innocence.
Has that report since ever been uncovered?
What had happened, John, was the journey of the debriefing report was Michael was executed on July the 12th, 79. They were probably fingers crossed. Nobody, that doesn't show up. Maybe he was lying. Maybe Scapatici was saying, maybe he was lying. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was. Maybe he was. I don't know. They never got it. They would try to get it. They couldn't find it. So about 3 years later, the kitchen floor, new tiles were going down. But the guy come up, this is 3 years later, 2 or 3 years later. So he said to Sean, my brother, Sean, for me to put those tiles down, I would need to pull that dresser out. And he says, sure, I can give you a hand. He says, that's okay. So do you want to do it now? He says, I'll pull it out. So the two of them pulled it out, and then behind the dresser was the cornflakes box with the debriefing report on it. It was in a brown envelope in the cornflakes box. So I got out in 1986. So I would have probably been 79, 80, 81, 80, probably 82. So I get out 4 years later and we go for a walk up to Shaw's Bridge and Sean puts his hand in his pocket and gives me this brown envelope. I says, what's this? And he says, that's our mixed debriefing report. Those efforts came looking at it. I would have given them it, but I couldn't find it. But he says, maybe it'll, I don't know, it's probably better in your hands than mine. So I held that, and that was the main plank that got him cleared in 2003. The IRA investigation seen that. I didn't give them an original. They got a copy, but they wanted to see the original, and they confirmed that it was true. It was an original because the paper was yellowed. And that was the main plank that got him cleared. When it came to Boucher in 2016, I'd met them in 2016. I mentioned this when I mentioned you. So he right away wanted it, but I says no. He says, well, can I have a copy of it? Yeah, so he has a copy of it. Operation Canova.
I won't keep you too much more. Thank you again, everything you're sharing. I appreciate it very much.
When you're talking about Scapatici and you're talking about the internal security unit, it's erroneous to blame everything on him. I know he died in April. But if he was sitting there, he would say, John, you need to listen to Seamus. I was a member of the Force Research Unit, but I can't be responsible for everything. And I wasn't a one-man band. And he's right. I had to be invited in. And for every case that I've studied, they're always invited in. They're invited in. Internal security must be invited in. Why? Because they need local knowledge. They need to know, what are we asking this guy? Who is he? Michael Kearney. Well, what are we asking him? I don't know. What do you want to ask him? They need local knowledge. They need somebody to say. The familiar face needs to say, well, ask him about the short strong bombs. Scapatici then goes in and says, okay, what about the short strong bombs, Mark? Or what about such and such, such and such? He's getting this information from the guy next door. Local knowledge. So he's invited in and he needs local knowledge. And it's not all about protecting Scapatici. Scapatici does not need to be protected. But it's working on a strategic initiative that the Brits have formulated to remove certain people. You know, for example, 1985, the branch decided to get rid of two informers to protect another one. So it's leaked to internal security, SCAP, that these two or informers. Skep is then told, pick them up. Do you see what's happening? It's the British that are the main puppet masters here. They've duped the IRA. The IRA are not the architects of the dirty war. If you talk about the architects of this particular war, the intelligence war, it's the British and the skullduggery that they were involved in. And that's the reason why we've served a writ on the Ministry of Defence in the murder of Michael Kearney.
Do you, I guess two questions. Do you think any members of, like, any previous handlers, any members of British security, any of them will end up facing the music, number one? And number two, do you think, like, the legal action you're going through now about your brother, do you think if that was to, like, fully resolve it, you know, resolve itself in a satisfactory way, would that like close a wound, or would it provide any kind of closure?
I've been at this since 40 years, and it doesn't seem to end. But Michael's spirit is there with me. He's helping me. I know that might sound strange, but he's never too far away. His spirit, I know he's left his mortal existence, but his spirit guides me. And I would ask him to help me, and he has up to now. So his journey's not over yet. His story's not over yet. And I take my lead from him, you know. But I'll always say to him, Mick, open up a door so I can walk through it. Give me an opportunity. And he has done that up to now, which is quite incredible. And he's not finished yet. But I'm looking after his case on Earth. And I know he can't do it for himself, so he's relying on me to do it, and I will get to the bottom of it. And I have been fortunate up to now that we've got so much further than a lot of cases. But it's not over yet. But we're near closure. We're near close. There's a couple of pieces of jigsaw John's still missing, you know. And that's. But I think Boucher could actually help us do that. Whether he's prepared to do it, I don't know. I've asked him to go the extra mile. Whether he's prepared to do that, where he's capable of doing it, I don't know. Only he can answer that. But I've told him to go the extra mile. It's not a 9-to-5 job. This is a vocation. And I don't know if John's into vocations, but if John Boucher's into vocations, then he will reach the end of this with me. If he's not, and if he's in the 9-to-5 job picking up 37 million, then he'll not get any further. He'll be another John Stevens, another John Stalker Stevens, another field inquiry.
On a personal level, do you think it would bring you any kind of closure to, if at least if it became, like, publicly known what you know about your brother, was that he wasn't actually a rat, and that was mislabeling. He was a victim of of this dirty war, as you call it. You know, would it bring closure to you to make that it public?
Yeah. That would be his legacy. You know what I mean? That you know, I'm just one of those people that if it's not sitting right, then it's not sitting right. It should sit right. And his death has never sat right with me since this whole case, since I took on the promise with my mum. And it hasn't sat right, and it's still not sitting right until we reach the conclusion. And I've outlined the conclusion, but the proposed conclusion. And if that happens, then yeah, for me personally, yeah, that would be closure. There is actually a case of closure here. I knew back in 2003, even at the mass, there was not, that it wasn't the end. And I told the IRA, this is, I'm going with the sanitized version, but there's more to this. There will be a part two. And this is part two that I'm involved in. It's not over yet. He's meant to release his report in June. It's now been put back to September, John Boucher, and he can confirm a lot of stuff. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you have the legacy trying to rush it through way through Parliament, where they know what their role is. They know that people like me are coming after them, and they know, oh my God, we need to stop this nutcase from chasing us. So they know that. So they're trying to bring in a legacy bill, which if it's ratified in September, after the summer recess, that'll give them a certain amount of cover, because they know their role was not a UN peacekeeping force. They know their role was a colonial. They know that this was a colonial war, and they know their role in it. So they're determined to cover their dirty tricks up and what their main role was, because they don't want their legacy, the British government's legacy on the North, they would rather have this. Oh, we were involved in trying to keep the two warring sides of apart when they weren't. They were up to their neck in dirty tricks, skullduggery. And as I say, they would like to say, oh, it was the IRA shot, Michael. No, it wasn't. Technically, the IRA were involved, but he's had a big role in the execution of my brother. And that changes the narrative. It does change the narrative. When you look at the statistics, and if I win this case, then I'm not saying I will, but I'm saying I'll try my best. But if I do, then it throws everything into the air, because you look at the statistics and say, well, the IRA shot this, the British Army shot these, and you go, whoa, hold on here. Hold on. You know, oh, technically, oh, but the IRA shot Michael Kearney? No.
They pulled the trigger, but yeah.
You see what I'm saying? The whole narrative has changed. And Michael's not the only case. He was the first. They were involved in other cases where they were setting people up for execution. Branch mom was asked recently, former branch mom, was that policy, what yous were doing, that skullduggery? And he says, the words he used was, it wasn't policy, it was practice. By that answer, I think it seems to be they were given a free hand.
Yeah, sure. There was a certain amount of blind eye and as long as you, I'm sure it was the case that as long as you didn't kick up too much hassle and bring too much heat onto the British government, then do what you like to get the job done, I'd imagine. Yeah.
So there you have in the prisons, I can talk about that, where they basically let the prison officers down, screw them, use them as cannon fodder. They were carrying on what they'd done, but there was no paper trail back to them and the brutality in the blocks. And now you have here, in the intelligence war, where they're non-accountable. You know what I mean? It's they're non-accountable. Their fingerprints are not there. Their fingerprints aren't on the hate blocks. Blame that on the prison officers, and their fingerprints aren't on this Michael Kearney's death. I blame that in the IRA. They're good at it. You know, they are good. You have to give them that. But they got their experience from Malaya in 1947, and then from Cyprus, and then Aden, and the North. So they've had a lot of experience, you know, so they've been good at it.
Very good. I'll leave you go there. Hopefully we'll speak again in the future when the investigation into Scappatici, your own legal efforts, plus the what was it called, the legacy and reconciliation, maybe we can speak again when they've wrapped up, and maybe more has come to light.
John, can I just advertise that book?
Of course, put it up a bit higher. Very good. No greater love than the memories of Seamus.
Memoirs of Seamus Kearney. It's you can get it at Coulternan Bookshop, Falls Road in West Belfast. As I say, it's a work in progress, John. That's where you've got me. It's not over yet. You have legacy. You have the serving of the writ, which was in May. So that's run alongside it, and then you have Boucher's report, which everyone over here, everyone, the whole media are waiting on with bated breath on him releasing that report. And as I say, it kept getting put back and put back and put back and put back. And that's frustrating. It's frustrating that we're waiting 7 years with nothing to show for it. But a lot of money been spent. 37 million, John. 37 million.
If I'm to make a prediction, I'd have to imagine that what will come out will be fairly minimal and it won't
soft landing. Soft landing.
And it won't actually implicate any British agents in a way that action would have to be taken. I'm sure it'll be the bare minimum
I agree. Bare minimum. But that's what I'm telling you. That's the truth. But that'll not appear in an official report.
Very good. Is there any final thoughts you want to leave us with there just before we wrap up?
That's the other thing on what I was saying. That's the report of the Independent Panel of Inquiry into the circumstances of the Hitch Block and Armagh prison protests. So anything I was saying to you, they've verified it in an international panel. And the international panel has come out in October 2020 about the Hitch Block situation. It was run by Richard Harvey, who has served on the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague, and the former Attorney General of Canada, Warren Allman and Richard Harvey. They were a panel. I submitted what I was saying to you about my experiences in the blocks, and there was about 90 witnesses, 90 people like me. And it said, this came out on October 20, and it was an independent panel made up of those people. It just says, having considered the findings of this report on the circumstances surrounding the Hate Block protest 76-81, having considered the evidence of former prisoners whose lives remain scarred by physical and psychological suffering and social disabilities, the panel unhesitatingly concludes that the inhuman conditions in which these prisoners were held were calculated to cause intense physical and mental suffering with the intention of humiliating and debasing prisoners and breaking their physical and moral resistance. Further, from the contextual evidence and expert opinion sought by the international panel regarding specific types of ill treatment and its impact, its conclusion is that many protesting prisoners in the Hate Blocks and HMP Armagh were subjected to torture. The state, the British state, should reject the proposition that the suffering of former prisoners was self-imposed or self-inflicted. It was not. It was the consequence of a purposeful policy implemented by the UK government, whose institutions were fully aware that their policies and practices violated international human rights law and standards and breached common law and statute. The international panel concludes, based on all the evidence received, that the ultimate legal and moral responsibility for this torture, inhuman and degrading treatment over a five-year period rests on the British Prime Minister and senior cabinet ministers who knew and approved of that treatment. That's conclusive, John. In other words, they would say to you, if they were listening, you know, they would say, the British government would say, don't listen to him. That was all self-inflicted. That's all IRA propaganda. But that's an international panel from the former Attorney General of Canada, Warren Allman, Richard Harvey, International War Crimes Tribunal, that it's the British were in the dock and they were responsible for the torture in the Hate Blocks. You know what I mean? And I, as I say, 90 of us give our testimonies, and that's been upheld by this panel. And the only thing now is Scabatici and my brother, the servant of the writ. That's another battle for another day, and that's a work in progress. I would like to reach a conclusion, John. I'd like to reach a stage where we win the writ, we win the court action. I don't know if we will or not. I'll do my best. And also that John Boucher doesn't run away and does what he's meant to do, and tells the truth about Scabatici and his role, and that role of a British military officer working for the British government.
Very good. Just one last small thing. You said if you win the action that you're taking, what does a win actually consist of? Will it be like a handler being convicted of misconduct?
No. Well, basically, John, what it would mean at this stage would be the writ served would be a case where we're waiting on Boucher, and if Boucher, you know, in the report simply says Michael's life could have been saved, and it was the security forces were responsible, they could have saved him, then that's them implicated. Therefore, that would be a win. We bring that to court, and then out of that, the British government would have to admit liability. That's what that means, liability. It doesn't mean criminal. That doesn't mean going to prison. I think we're beyond that, John. You know what I'm saying? If you're heading down the road of legacy and all that, the British government are not interested in locking people up anymore. They want to draw a line under it. That's what we're heading towards. But that action there would probably be one of the last before that steel door comes down. And it might fail. It might fail because the British could be just simply say, no, it's all over. We've drew a line under that. That's it over. We're handing this over now to Declan Morgan, who commences in May 2024, a truth commission. Do you get me? That's what they're talking about now. So there's a lot going on, John, a lot of complexities.
Very good. Thank you for everything you shared. Now we've gone through like your entire life, and there's been things in your life that would be the most tragic aspect of someone else's life, but you've had many of them. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, and we'll speak again when your thing gets wrapped up, hopefully with a positive conclusion. You know?